Episode 8 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We are delighted at the uptake for this and looking forward to many more of these. We are lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. And I'm joined today by two of our regulars and two Steptoe guests, as well as an interview guest. The regulars are Michael Battis, formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department, now a partner in Steptoe's New York office. Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where he oversaw criminal computer crime prosecutions, among other things, and is now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe. Finally, our guest commentators from Steptoe are Stephen Heifetz, who was also formerly with the Justice Department and the CIA, and most recently was at DHS as a Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Office of Policy Development, now a partner at Steptoe & Johnson. And finally, Stephanie Roy, a telecommunications partner here at Steptoe. A little later, we will introduce Ed Straws, the Executive Chairman of Straws Friedberg, to talk about some of the cybersecurity issues that he has been facing. I am Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS, and returned again to Steptoe & Johnson as a partner. Let's get started. There's a couple of things that I wanted to talk about before we turn to Stephanie and Stephen for a little deeper dive. And one of them is this week in Snowden, Snowden has released a report suggesting that the Australians spied on an American law firm giving advice in trade matters to a Indonesian government agency. And that has sparked a variety of responses here, considerable angst among law firms about what this means for their liability, suggestions by the ineffable Larry Klayman that somehow this gives his standing claim greater strength. Jason, what does all this mean?
Well, Stuart, I think that this, despite the heat this generated in the press, and especially in the legal press, I think there's less that meets the eye. First, there's no indication that the NSA was doing the spying. As you said, this was being done by the Australians, although the Australians reportedly told the NSA was going on and got advice from the NSA General Counsel's Office about how to do it in compliance with the law. But it's not clear what, if any, information was provided to the NSA and what the NSA did with it and whether it was in compliance with its own guidelines. Second, I think most lawyers who work with foreign clients are probably aware of a substantial risk that their communications with those overseas clients are being spied on by the foreign governments. So I doubt this.
Well, you'd have to be an idiot not to think that your international calls are subject to intercept by other governments. Certainly the government at the other end can.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so I doubt that a lot of the surprise that's being expressed about this is really genuine. And then in terms of the prospects for liability for law firms, I think there's a lot of exaggeration there, too. There's no suggestion that the law firm in this case, Mayer Brown, was in any way negligent or responsible for the fact that a foreign government was intercepting its communications. This isn't a situation where the law firm had a breach of its own systems or where there was any culpability on the part of the law firm for allowing the communications to be breached. So I think that the notion that there's liability here is really nonsense. You know, as you alluded to, it is being used as part of an effort to get the Supreme Court to revisit the Clapper versus Amnesty International decision from last year, in which a group of journalists and lawyers and human rights organizations challenged the FISA provisions that permit monitoring of communications with non-U.S. persons without a warrant. And the lawyers who were among that group of plaintiffs argued that communications with their overseas clients were likely being intercepted, forcing them to travel overseas and otherwise to incur expenses associated with trying to keep those communications confidential. And the Supreme Court held in a 5-4 ruling that those plaintiffs lacked standing because they can only speculate that their communications with their clients are being intercepted. Now the Center for Constitutional Rights and Klayman are trying to pursue this revelation as a vehicle to get the Supreme Court to revisit that, arguing that this makes it more than speculative that their communications with their overseas clients are being intercepted. So we'll have to see what, if any, action the Supreme Court takes. And just last week, the ABA sent a letter to General Alexander from the NSA asking for information about the NSA's policies and practices regarding the surveillance of attorney-client privilege communications and whether those policies and practices were followed here in the Mayor Brown case. And it'll be interesting to see what, if any, information the NSA provides in response to that request.
Yeah, well, if foreign government interceptions of American lawyers' calls gives you standing to sue the NSA, then these guys should just call Moscow and ask to speak to Snowden, and they can be guaranteed that they'll have their calls intercepted by the Russians.
Well, especially now that the Olympics are over, Snowden's probably available.
That's right. Okay, let's move on to the other Snowden development. As usual, there's lots of angst in Europe. Angela Merkel has said, now I have my government together, let's talk about a European, keep our data in Europe plan. The European Parliament is trying to say that the EU-US trade deal would be dead unless there's some kind of deal on spying. Michael, does this add up to anything that U.S. companies should be concerned about?
I don't think it does really lead to much. I think the whole Snowden affair has led to a drop in business for U.S.-owned cloud providers. I think there have been European companies that have decided not to store their company's data with a U.S.-owned cloud company based in Europe. But, what they're talking about now is having their own version of the Internet, effectively, where there are no communications with the United States or communications stored in the United States. I mean, it's hard for me to even describe what they're talking about because it's completely unworkable. And the idea that you're going to have communications that are secure from NSA because they're being provided by European companies is just something I can't get my mind around. And even if it were possible, it still begs the question of whether the communications are really secure from surveillance by some foreign government. I mean, the French government, the German government are both active players in electronic surveillance. And aside from which, storing the information in Europe, if anything, makes it easier for NSA to get it because they don't have the restrictions that they have on accessing systems and information stored in the United States. So I still think all of this is more about politics than about substance. That said, however, once you get politicians involved, there is the chance that things like a trade pact could go off the rails because those things are usually difficult enough to get passed through national governments and, in this case, through the additional layer of EU government and parliament in Brussels. So if, as difficult as it is already, things like this can have a real-world impact on something like the U.S.-EU trade agreement.
I do think that's right. The U.S.-EU trade deal was always sort of a feel-good initiative looking for people who really needed it, and it had gotten watered down to the point where it was looking like something that was being done because, well, we need to do something. It wasn't clear what the trade benefits were. And because of that, Fast Track is in deep trouble on the Hill. The president's not going to get it anytime soon because of Democratic resistance. And for the same reason, the European Parliament is starting to lay down markers that will be very hard for the U.S. government to accept. So, yeah, I think the TTIP is in trouble, but it was probably always in trouble. It was a question of what was going to kill it. Ironically, protectionism for European spies may turn out to be the issue, making sure that the French spies have plenty of jobs and plenty of data to spy on. Is going to be a new element for the negotiations. Well, let's also return to another continuing theme this week in Target. I was kind of surprised to see an analyst put a number on the table for the Target breach that was over $1 billion. That's the biggest number I've seen, and it apparently has to do with likely liability to banks. Jason, is this a real number?
Well, I don't know if the precise number that he articulated, which is actually a range of 400 million to 1.1 billion. So at either end of that range, you're talking about real money. I don't know how realistic those precise numbers are, but the number will potentially be quite large. The payment card industry has fines that it can impose on retailers or on banks that get passed on to retailers if the retailer is deemed not to be compliant with the payment card industry standards. But there are also fines relating to the cost of that are measured per card compromise in a breach, even if the retailer was compliant. And so even under the best of circumstances, if Target is deemed to be compliant, just the sheer number of cards that were potentially compromised at a potential range of $50 to $90 fine per card, that adds up pretty fast to a very big number. So the cost to Target, however you slice it, however you calculate it, is going to be very high. And it's not, of course, as you know, limited to fines from the payment card industry. There are estimates from the payment card industry that the cost of card replacement is already at about $200 million, and that represents just over half of the 40 million cards compromised. So there's another 20 million cards coming, and that doesn't count the cost of fraudulent transactions. You can certainly expect banks and credit card companies to seek indemnification from Target for the losses associated with fraudulent transactions on the cards that are compromised. And, of course, that doesn't count the consumer class action. So from all those different sources, when you add it up, the overall cost might end up being north of $1 billion, but either way, it's going to be a very, very large number.
Boy, that is really staggering. Makes you rethink who you do your HVAC contracting with. All right.
My guy's probably not using the internet, so I have no problems.
I can get my guy to return my phone calls, so he's not even using the phone.
All right. Well, let's turn to another news-making event, which was the FCC's struggles with net neutrality and with a split the difference kind of decision out of the D.C. Circuit. Now the FCC says, or at least a majority of the FCC says, it's got a plan. It's not going to appeal the D.C. Circuit's decision. Instead, it's going to use the favorable parts of that decision to engage in a certain amount of net neutrality. I don't know. I would call it jawboning, but maybe it's more than that. Stephanie, what is it that the chairman of the FCC has said he's going to do, and who's going to be mad about it?
Sure. As our listeners who listen to our the second podcast in this series know that when the D.C. Circuit struck down the FCC's net neutrality rules early last month, it did so because they were too close to common carrier regulations. And the FCC has so far declined to classify broadband access providers as common carriers. And the absence of that classification, they're not permitted to impose common carrier rules and obligations. But at the same time, the D.C. Circuit did uphold the FCC's general authority under Section 706 of the Telecommunications Act of 1996 to regulate in the interest of expanding access to broadband and in the interest of broadband access. So the opinion of the court really did kind of act as an invitation of sorts for the FCC to evaluate how it could use this Section 706 authority to put in place rules that would work toward the same objectives as the stricken net neutrality regulations. In particular, the FCC said it will look at its ways to implement or achieve the same goals or similar goals as its no blocking rules. The net neutrality regulation said broadband access providers weren't allowed to block any content from reaching their subscribers. And the D.C. Circuit's opinion actually talked about or hinted at ways in which a no blocking rule may be far enough away from a common carriage obligation that the FCC might be able to get away with it. And so the chairman has said no more or less, really, than that they're going to take a look at that. And then they're going to also take a look at implementation of anti-discrimination rules, a la its data roaming order. And here we have a decision from the D.C. Circuit in the recent past saying that the FCC was within its authority to require interconnection in, roaming on the data services between wireless carriers, even though these data services are information services in the same category that broadband access providers are. And they said because the rule was based upon no unreasonable discrimination, and what would be reasonable in a certain case depends upon a list of factors that the FCC articulated, and that it would evaluate it on a case-by-case basis, therefore putting it into an adjudicatory posture. So in the context of that, Chairman Wheeler has said they're going to take a look at adopting and apply, adapting really that type of structure to broadband access providers. And it's not too far afield to think that they might put a little bit more teeth to their transparency requirements. These rules were not struck down by the D.C. Circuit, but they may look for ways to beef up those requirements that the broadband access providers have to inform precisely how they discriminate and or prioritize and or decide what traffic to pass through and when and in what priority. So,
I've heard people say that the FCC's role is lecturing monopolists to behave better. Is that really what this is going to boil down to? You must disclose whether you're tailoring or shaping traffic. If there's a big stink, the FCC will accuse you of unreasonably discriminating or blocking in an unfair fashion and use 706 to punish you. Is that the likely outcome here?
Oh, I think the likely outcome is that you'll have a regulatory regime that depends upon a third party bringing an action against the allegedly misbehaving player in the market. And like any regulatory regime that depends on that type of structure, it's less direct. The FCC is going to be in a position really to take direct action, maybe on the transparency rules, yes, but not necessarily on the discrimination rules that it's looking at. And those are really the rules that everyone's looking toward. But at the same time, knowing that there's a possibility of this type of action, it does regulate behavior. So I can't, like, dispute the notion that some people talk about it's putting this penumbra of potential action over the actions of the what some might term the monopolist broadband provider to the individual home in some cases. But, I think they would have an effect on the behavior of the companies. I don't think they'll have as direct of an effect as the net neutrality rules that were struck down will. And we have to wait and see. The FCC said they're going to publish an NPRM, a notice of proposed rulemaking. Meanwhile, they've opened a docket, are accepting comments. And I think one of the things that's interesting and that we may see play out in this proceeding that they've just opened up, there's a lot of news lately about the Netflix-Bloomberg agreement that was reached. And this doesn't have to do with the access that the individual consumer, not Netflix-Bloomberg, excuse me.
Comcast,
exactly. Decisions. So individual Comcast subscriber, it has to do with the other side of the pipe to Comcast. It has to do with the backbone to Comcast. And that would not have been captured by the net neutrality regulations, as has been widely reported in the press the last couple of days. And we'll see if it influences this proceeding at all.
Well, this does sound deeply ambiguous, and on the whole, probably good news for all the big players, whether you're Amazon and Google, or Bloomberg on the one hand, or the ISPs on the other. It sounds as though if you can make a big enough stink about a particular behavior, you can probably get the FCC interested. If you can, but on the whole, the carriers will be, or the ISPs will be able to do more stuff than they were able to do before in terms of shaping traffic and offering special deals for expedited delivery of content to favored customers.
I think that's exactly right, because there's no longer going to be really prescriptive regulations on what you can and cannot do, especially with respect to prioritization and access. They're more likely to be general standards that require an adjudication to enforce. So I think that's exactly right.
Well, once again, the big winners, Washington lawyers, and if you need one, call Stephanie. Speaking of that, let's talk a little bit about, so this is this week in nudge regulation, I think, because remarkably there's a piece of cybersecurity legislation that is actually moving on the Hill, a bill put out by the Homeland Security Committee in the House, seems to have reasonably good prospects in the House, maybe not so much in the Senate. But I've asked Stephen Heifetz to take a look at that bill and see if it amounts to anything more than just saying, cybersecurity is a good thing, or whether it actually has some potential impact. And he's found at least one aspect of nudge regulation in it that might have an impact. Stephen, what's going on in this bill?
Thanks, George. So, yeah, this is the National Cybersecurity and Critical Infrastructure Protection Act of 2013, more efficiently known right now as H.R. 3696. And as you said, it's passed the House Homeland Security Committee. It passed on February 5th with some bipartisan support, and by many accounts has a reasonable chance of passage in the whole House. Prospects in the Senate, as you suggest, are not great. But there are pieces that could make it into a compromise bill. And so one piece in particular that we'll focus on today, but there are three pieces worth noting. First, H.R. 3696 codifies the National Cybersecurity and Communications Integration Center at the Department of Homeland Security. This is a primary mechanism within the government to coordinate industry preparation and response to cyber attacks. That piece, again, codifies the existing state of affairs, and so while that might make it into a future bill, not particularly important. Second piece is that the bill says that the Department of Homeland Security cannot issue new cybersecurity regulations under the Act. It mandates the issuance of various types of cybersecurity standards and guidance, but comes down firmly against the issuance of coercive regulations. Obviously, whether to issue coercive cybersecurity regulations is one of the key issues in debates about cybersecurity legislation, and this bill comes down firmly against the issuance of coercive regulation. But third, and this goes to the Stuart's reference to nudge regulation, and somewhat contradictory to the no new regulation point, the legislation would amend the Safety Act, which is now more than a decade old, to encompass what it calls qualified cyber incidents. And by doing this, it would create strong incentives for the private security to create and to use cybersecurity technology. So a bit of background about the Safety Act is in order. This is the Safety Act created a program that is run by the Department of Homeland Security to provide liability protection for producers and users of approved anti-terrorism technology. So if a company gets its anti-terrorism technology approved and an act of terrorism occurs, the producers and users of that technology get certain legal protections, immunization from liability, if they're sued on grounds that the technology was insufficient or that it didn't work properly. The amendments in H.R. 3696 would extend this idea to cybersecurity technologies. So in the event of a qualifying cyber incident, producers and users of approved, DHS-approved cybersecurity technologies similarly would get protections from liability. And this is a great example of nudge regulation, meaning regulating by creating behavioral incentives and disincentives rather than mandating particular action. And the Department of Homeland Security does a lot of regulation in this way. And it's likely that we'll see a lot of this nudge regulation with respect to cybersecurity. This is a leading example and one that we could see in, if this bill doesn't become law, there's a reasonable chance that the Safety Act amendments in H.R. 3696 could be attached to a different legislative vehicle. So it's important to watch what happens with these amendments in particular. And particularly within these amendments, it's important to watch what happens to the definition of a qualifying cyber incident. Right now, that term is defined very broadly so that qualifying cyber incidents might occur many times each week. If that language were to stay as broad as it is, these Safety Act amendments could become a key feature of cybersecurity law and regulation.
This is a big deal. I mean, it's complicated and it would be hard to pull together, but it would mean that people could come into the department and say, here's my plan for how to secure, my HVAC connections. And I've got insurance to cover people who could be harmed if my system fails. And I'd like you to approve my plan, and if it meets current standards, the government would, DHS would approve the plan. And then if your HVAC security plan failed, your liability would be limited to the amount of your insurance, more or less, right?
That's right. There are lots of companies that have come in, hundreds, even thousands that have come in and have obtained approval for their anti-terrorism technology. The frequency with which that becomes an issue in litigation is has been zero thus far because there have been zero triggering terrorism events. But for what would make this such a big deal in the cyber realm is the frequency with which one could invoke these sorts of protections. So that is very much, as you say, a big deal, worth watching the way the what happens with the Safety Act amendments, because if this were to go through, one could imagine lots of companies seeking approval of their cybersecurity technology, and then many incidents in which the Safety Act protections would then be invoked.
Yeah, so really, Target could have spent $100 million lobbying for this and would have saved $9 out of 10.
Yes, conceivably right.
Okay, well, thanks, Stephen. This does bear watching. I suspect it's the kind of thing that, since it might actually have an impact, will soon become controversial and then hard to enact. But for now, it's a very interesting prospect. And now let me turn to our special guest, Ed Strauss of Strauss Friedberg. I do want to mention that in addition to doing this interview with us, he has agreed that Tom Heibarger from his D.C. office can appear on a webinar that we are doing later this week called The Data Breach Nightmare. For those of you who haven't heard enough about Target and its travails and all the other risks that are associated with data breaches, this will be a detailed and multiple attorney walk through the issues of what to do when you suffer a data breach, what your liabilities might be, and what the first things you should do in the event of a breach are. So I do want to thank Ed for his willingness to participate in that webinar. That'll be Wednesday at 11:30 Washington time. I'm going to let Michael Vadas, who is in the room with him, lead the interview. But Ed, thank you so much for appearing on the program today.
No, it's my pleasure, Stuart.
Thanks, Stuart. Well, Ed, you and I go back a long ways now. I hate to count years, but we've known each other for about 16 years from when we were both at the FBI. I was down at headquarters starting up what was then called the National Infrastructure Protection Program, and you were up here where you had started the Computer Crime Office in the New York field office. You know, I like to tell people that I was involved in starting the computer crime program at the FBI, but you were doing computer crime investigations before there was a program. And now you left the Bureau, I think in 2000, to start up what has become one of the world's premier digital forensics and investigations firms, Stroz Friedberg. You know, back when I was leaving the government and years later, the people I knew from the Bureau went and became, at best, heads of security for a big bank or a big company, or they got hired by one of the big accounting firms. You decided to start your own company. That's a very rare thing for an FBI agent. What was your thought process? How'd you go about doing that?
Thanks, Mike. I think the at the time when I made the change in 2000, this field was really just becoming appreciated by people. And I had seen enough really smart trial attorneys, assistant U.S. attorneys, defense attorneys, who knew what kind of facts really made a difference to them, who knew, and I knew what they needed to know. And because I had sat as the head of what was then the third computer crime squad in the country, I had a real eye-opener to the legal significance of the data that was inside a computer after an event occurred. And I felt that that this was going to be a game changer. And I wasn't looking for a game changer. It would have been more likely for me to take a position or a job somewhere, as you described. But I really just felt that this was something that was a precious and special opportunity, and I believed in it. So plan A was to leave the FBI, start the firm, hold myself out as a consultant and be able to help on this. And if that crashed and burned and didn't work, I had a big enough ego to think I could still go back on plan B and get a job with one of those other places. But that was the thinking. I felt I had a bit of a safety net, and it's worked out very well for us.
And now you've got, you were telling me before we started the podcast, you've got 300 employees located around the world, including offices in Hong Kong, London, across the United States, and Zurich, just opening. What types of people do you look for now? When you started, I know you brought in a bunch of former assistant United States attorneys, some former FBI and other law enforcement investigators. Has the nature of the threat changed such that you bring in people with different backgrounds now, or still fairly similar to what you were doing back in 2000?
You know, Ed, the same elements that we were drawing from back in those days continue to be present, but they've extended. So in the beginning, the assistant U.S. attorneys and the former agents who made up the firm, I think, really understood how to conduct an investigation, how to look for the elements of a violation, what intent might look like in a given situation. And this became important even if you weren't talking about a computer intrusion. Even if you were just talking about a traditional white-collar matter or an internal investigation, people were doing interviews, and they wanted to know whether the representations in those interviews were corroborated by the evidence in the computer that was invoked and used during those events. And so just to be able to talk about what you might be able to identify in a computerized device, how you would preserve it so not to change anything, and then how you'd analyze it to compare it to the interviews was a big part of what we were offering. It wasn't really until, I would say,
after we were in business probably for about 3 or 4 years, that we really started to get called into events where there were computer intrusions from hacking break-ins. And I think some of that was because even though it was occurring, it wasn't occurring quite on the same scale as it is today. You would have events where people would engage in just denial of service attacks. They hadn't even become distributed at that point. And so they would look for protecting their network. But really, I think a lot of business executives were concerned with just functionality. They just wanted to make sure their computers would keep working. We didn't see that market as a natural adjacency at that point in time. Today, we need to have people who can reverse engineer malware code, who are very compatible with legal thinking, because we're not a law firm, but we want to be an empowering force for the law firms that represent the commercial clients. And whether that is because of an internal incident, a computer hack of some type, or no hack, no incident, just litigation and trying to understand, well, you know, how do we really know what the truth is in this situation? You find yourself drawing from the same digital expertise that was at the core of what caused us to form the company, but is now being aimed in those different needs that companies might have. Even, I would say in closing, just the point on even forensic accounting. Right now, people have some of the same questions they always had about accounting matters and forensic accounting. But because general ledgers are now databases, and the skill set that you need to see to the bottom of that and be able to know whether or not you even have reached the bottom really requires not just accounting skills, but the digital forensic skills that were at the core of our firm. So that has been sort of the evolution as to how it's changed over the 14 years.
You know, every once in a while you read another article where some columnist says, you know, what the NSA and the FBI need to do are hire former hackers because they're the ones with the technical expertise. Do you have any former hackers in your employ right now?
No. I've got my prejudice is not to do that. It's the analogy I use sometimes is like they're very skilled surgeons with dirty hands. You know, the operation may go fine, but then you die of an infection.
Friends will kill you.
I think looking at the individual is the methodology that we start with, and we want to have a comfort level with those people. If they are very skilled, it doesn't mean that you bring them onto the team. It would mean that if you need their skill set, you'd have to modularly sort of cherry-pick that expertise, share certain information, and get it back. But I don't believe in hiring them. In fact, there are enough instances, some of them public, the Gonzalez case, I think, where other agencies have come to regret that they brought them in as closely as they did. And so I have a prejudice against doing that.
Mm-hmm. You talked about the changing nature of the business because of the way the threat has changed. Are you dealing with a lot of advanced persistent threat attacks, you know, a nation-state level intrusion from a China or a Russia or some other sophisticated entity? Are your clients experiencing those? And if so, what sort of different challenges do those present for you?
Yes. The short answer is yes. The advanced persistent threats, the APTs, we sort of see them in waves, and the waves don't just last for a few weeks. I mean, it can be months and months. And I would actually agree with you that when I think of a true advanced persistent threat, it's probably nation state driven. It's a little bit of a fuzzy line, but you're not going to find APT behind a single individual. It's unlikely anyway. And we do see them when they occur. I think more often than not, the government is the one telling the company that they have this problem. And it is everything that acronym uses. It is advanced, meaning that you are unlikely to have seen this type of malware and the way it works before. It is persistent in the sense that it's not just a single effort to get in. It is coded in a way to continue effort, affecting itself. And it's a threat in the sense that there's somebody behind the code on the other end who wants to use it for a certain purpose. It may be just to gain intelligence on you. It may be to plant something in your network that could actually be deployed to do something malicious. But I think a well-run computer network, And if you just think of the legal landscape we were talking about before, you can't afford to be in a position where you don't know that there's malware all through your network residing on machines, what it does, whether it's been activated, you know, to what degree has it taken information away. But this is increasingly the kind of world that we're in. The network is working fine, yet it's badly compromised. And so when we do see these things, very often it's the government tapping the client on the shoulder. And then it's a real question, because the government typically in these situations only shares a limited amount of information with the client, enough for them to get started to do their investigation. The government, as you know, doesn't come in and say, we'll fix your network.
Mm-hmm.
They say, here are a string of IP addresses, here are some ports, and we see activity on these dates. You should look into it. And that is usually enough for the client, the law firm, or the firm like ours to begin sort of going through the audit trail of that activity and saying, whoa, you know, now I see that we do have a problem. Get those machines that are emanating these signals, forensically analyze them, and then you begin to reverse engineer the malware so that you know where else to go and look for it. It is a tedious, time-consuming, expensive episode. And very often, the origination point, if it can be determined, is overseas. It doesn't have to be. But we see it in waves. And I think there's a little bit of a blurring of lines when you see, say, for example, the target matter and what occurs. That's pretty sophisticated, you know, attack. And it had a certain persistence to it. But it was more designed for property theft and for the kind of thing that leads to a direct monetary impact. The worst things that we see are the ones where it's intellectual property theft and trying to get trade secrets and just very confidential information. That is a lot trickier to detect and is more likely to go on for a long period of time without detection than the ones that go after credit cards.
Now, when the government comes in and brings
Can I jump in for a second?
Sure, go ahead.
Ed made a great couple of points here. The government is, these are my words, not his, more or less useless other than to tell you you're screwed. They can't do much more than that. And you're on your own. You spend a boatload of money and you end up throwing the guys out of your network, and they're back again in a month or 2 months with a new zero day or some other attack. And I find this strategically unsustainable. And that leads me to the conclusion that we need deterrence, not just prevention. And to my mind, the only way we're going to get deterrence is if we let the companies that are suffering these attacks do a better job of tracking their attackers and figuring out which of their competitors are benefiting from these intellectual property thefts, and then going after the competitors. There's a lot of problems with that, but I can't believe that the current method in which you just spend hundreds of thousands of dollars a month to get people out who will be back again, and you get no help from the government, is sustainable.
Yeah, Stuart, there are points you make that I agree with and are definitely characterize the situation. I'd say a couple of things based on our experience with this. When you find out kind of what's going on inside your network and you deconstruct the code, our clients don't want the government coming in and asking, you know, if they can do it. And in some instances, the government has asked our clients if they can put a sniffer inside their network to gather packets and gain information that would help them to diagnose the situation along with the client. And most of the times our clients aren't too crazy about that. I've seen it done.
I actually had a client once who got that offer from the FBI, and about 4 months later they actually arrested him and charged him with a crime, which they clearly were investigating when they came by, and maybe there was no connection, that has left me pretty skeptical about letting the government into my network too.
Well, that's one aspect, and those are sort of two examples of, I guess, outcomes that can occur. The other is that a lot of times what we find, this is where I think it transverses into security, and how a network is run. And I'll even stray into legal concept a little bit here, which is negligence. Because in some instances, the way the network is constructed, it is not segmented in a way that allowed the victim company to make sure that its crown jewel content was only located on certain components of the network, that the traffic to those components was routed in a way where you could monitor it sufficiently to look for aberrations, and therefore would even have a chance to detect the condition that you were now investigating because the government tapped you on the shoulder. So a lot of times the episode that you go through does help tighten up security because it requires the audit committee or whoever's looking at this to ask better questions. Another part from what you said stimulated a thought in my mind, which is that even if you want to hit back, if you go down that road, and I'm not advocating that, but if you do, you're going to need to do some of the same work to determine the origination point. Because a lot of times, what appears to be the point of origination in the logs is really just a relay station for yet a deeper level where the source is actually to be found. And a lot of times the source of the problem is identified in part by deconstructing the malware and looking at the coding conventions, and sometimes they even leave little clues inside the malware. It's actually kind of a funny game that are very important in determining who might be responsible for this, as you say, who might be benefiting from it. What you do with that information, I think, is a separate question, but you can't even get to that point unless you're careful about reversing and auditing through what has occurred on your network as a result of the experience.
Are your clients clamoring for the solution that Stuart advocates? Or, you know, do they say, I want to hit back, tell me how I can do it, tell me, you know, is it legal?
Well, given that we only have the most pristine and white shoe clients, they tend not to think that way. What I have found is that people do want to know where this came from, what occurred, and who did what with it. And I don't find a lot of requests to hit back, but I think it's out there and people look for it. What I find, and in fact, I'm just summarizing a briefing right now for one of our clients, their intellectual property is gone. And it was taken by a partner. It was taken by a joint venture partner. And now you're in a very difficult situation because you can't attack the very entity that you're in the boat with, you know, because they depend on, there's a codependency here. Even though they may have strong protest, or strongly protest what's been done and look for a way to say, don't ever do this again. And we want a remediation plan that's going to see how much of our data is on your network. So what we find is that even when you have, proven what the source is on the problem, it doesn't lead to a clean situation where you punch them in the nose because that's who you're depending on for your bigger business plan. So it gets kind of complicated in my experience.
Sounds like the relationship between the U.S. and China.
Yeah, you could use that as an example. But it does. To Stuart's example, sometimes the adversary is not one like that. It's an organized crime group or it's somebody who, I think if you did hit back, it would seem to be a more suitable kind of thing. But I'd say the only way we would entertain helping a client with something like that is, A, if they're a law firm, because we very much want to be drafting behind legal advice, felt that it was something that could be deployed. And then secondly, if we felt that the evidence to take the action that was proposed was actually so clearly indicated by the evidence that you really knew where it was coming from. And in some situations, we see where the evidence that our client is looking at is being misinterpreted, either because they're wrong about it or it's not complete enough, and then we do further digging, and it shows that what they thought was happening is exactly what was not happening. And it's a bigger problem or a smaller problem, so you really have to kind of be experienced on what is this positive evidence, you know, to say when is it really strong enough, and not too many people are good at that.
Right. Stuart, you had something you wanted to ask?
No, I think this is useful. I guess I would say that I'm not sure whether striking back is the right analogy. It's more a question of can you continue to follow the evidence where it leads you? And, you know, can if you have reason to believe that they are pulling your stuff down to a particular command and control server, and you think you know what, because you can see them logging on, that you know what the log-on credentials are to go to that site and see if there's, if your stuff is there and whether you can retrieve it or re-encrypt it or make it useless to them. There are people at CSIPs who would say, oh, I'm sorry, you're outside your network. You can't do that. That's a violation of this Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which strikes me as kind of nutty. That's not about hacking back, except in a very technical sense. And it's enormously valuable in doing exactly what Ed says, which is trying to figure out exactly what happened and where your data is.
Yeah, Stuart, that's a good point. If I can just make a distinction, which you walk into, there are some advanced persistent threats that do not lead to somebody having an account on the network. They can lead to that, but sometimes they just don't. When somebody gains an account on your network and logs in the way you say, I do think that that standard of proof for establishing who is behind this is much clearer. And it's just that not all hacks go to that to that level. But if you have that, I think you're in the zone where a discussion about the merits of doing something the way you talk about has a lot more merit. And whether you hack back or just shut it down or, you know, there's a lot of things I think you can do when you have clear, very good evidence as to who's behind what and what steps are they taking on your network. If they get an account on your network, then it's a better game.
How often?
If they get an account on your network, you ought to display a banner to them saying that they've consented to you inspecting their network.
Good point.
If you discover criminality on the network, not because the FBI told you it was going on, but you discover it in the first instance, and there's clearly a crime that's been committed, do you tend to advise your clients to contact law enforcement or not tend to, or do you not have a tendency either way? I mean, you know, 15 years ago, we were the ones out there saying, you really need to contact law enforcement. They won't come take over your network. You know, it's not going to be the nightmare everybody tells you. But what do you tell people now?
We have a slight tendency to advise them to go to law enforcement if the circumstances warrant it. So if we see something going on in a network and it turns out that it's an internal matter, I think the stakes are a little different, and you don't necessarily jump to that because the problem, it's our point of origin and what's going on is much more within the control of the client, and they can decide kind of how far they want to go with this. Contrast that with an external event where somebody has broken into your network remotely. And very often, in order to pursue that logically, A, you're going to need legal process. So, you know, we're already invoking, you know, if a law firm hasn't been brought in already, we're advising them, you know, to do so. Secondly, just if it turns out that the actions you foresee are going to lead to a search warrant or a takedown because if it's a criminal group or in some ways is known to us from prior cases as being related to an organized crime group, I don't see that as a good civil remedy, you know, or a civil sort of, you know, pathway to remedy that situation. Because law enforcement very often will know things that they won't come tell you and knock on your door. They might not even know that it has a relationship to your company. But if you have an intelligent dialogue with the people who do this, it's happened to us where they say, oh, we know that group, or we know that those people, or we can't tell you a lot about it, but we would like to, you know, have an interview with you and use the information perhaps in either a search warrant or an attack in some way. One of the early cases when I started the firm, I had a client whose online trading platform was attacked by some former employees, and they did it remotely, and we were able to use the information to get a search warrant and ultimately an arrest warrant and shut it down in 24 hours. If we didn't have law enforcement behind us, there was no way to bring about that kind of an outcome without vigilantism or something, which we certainly weren't going to go into. So we sometimes think that law enforcement has intelligence that can really help triangulate what's going on and the authority and the power to do something if the circumstances warrant it.
Yeah, in my experience, the question has more often been, is it a big enough matter to get their interest? Because there's no point in telling them if they won't consider it important enough to actually do an investigation.
Yeah, that's true. Sometimes what we do find, though, is even though our client is a small experience, it is one more tentacle of a bigger problem, and they've already aggregated that, and this is one more. So it just feeds into the action
that they were going to take anyway, because you were just one part of a bigger problem. So that that phenomenon occurs also.
Right. Well, I'm standing between you and lunch, and so unless Stuart or Jason has a question.
Thank you so much. This has been really fascinating, and it shows that you you made a much better career choice years ago than either Michael or I did. We appreciate your coming on. We also appreciate your having somebody from your firm participate in the webinar on Wednesday. Thank you very much. This has been episode 8 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. I want to thank Michael Vadas, Jason Weinstein, Stephen Heifetz, Stephanie Roy, and especially Ed Straz for their participation today. We hope you'll join us next week for insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government. For more information, please visit our website at www.steptocyberblog.com.